Okay, fishes, welcome back to Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Paul.
And we have reached lucky number 13.
That's right, episode 13. End of the tunnel, double entendre, if ever there was one, as Lincoln's execution is now only 36 hours away.
And he is stuck in ADSEG, which stands for Administrative Segregation, which is also known as Solitary Confinement.
And the shoe.
The shoe.
Right.
This is a really, really, really exciting episode. We have a lot to talk about.
Yes, we do.
Before the Calistine Index, quick question.
Yeah.
How are you today? We haven't said hi.
Oh, I'm very well. Thank you for asking. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
How are you doing?
I'm really good.
I didn't ask just because you asked.
That's okay. Curious. It's okay, if you do. Life is great. And we're about to launch in real time so that the people who are listening know. Our actual podcast launches a week from tomorrow. So we are doing all kinds of amazing details.
It's almost as tense as Lincoln's impending execution. That just plays in my house all day long. All right.
Every time I turn around, I hear gong. I hear a bell and I think I'm about to be murdered. Okay. Yeah.
Are you ready? Ready for the Calistine Index?
Absolutely. I am now ready.
Okay. So, end of the tunnel. Was written by Paul T. Schuring and directed by Sanford Bookstaver, premiered on November 28th, 2005, which I didn't look, but I have to imagine was Thanksgiving week, and premiered to a whopping 12.18 million viewers.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can I just interrupt really quick? My production draft of this episode is dated November 1st. So that is 4 weeks between shooting and airing.
Wow, dude.
That is bonkers, insane. Bananas and nuts. Yeah. Okay, sorry. Coming back, the show's competition were our now usual suspects, Las Vegas on NBC, 2.5 Men on CBS, Monday Night Football on ABC, where the Colts beat the Steelers, 26-7.
Yeah.
Okay. The synopsis of the show from imdb.com reads, the escape is about to go through when the team hits a stainless steel snag. While Veronica is just a moment too late to get all the information she needs to prove Lincoln's innocence.
And out there in the big bad world, the United Nations Climate Change Conference, what a hoax, finalized the Kyoto Protocol designed to curb greenhouse gas emissions, whatever those
are. And fix climate change. Good job. Uh-huh.
Yes. That's glad that was taken care of. The House of Representatives renewed the Patriot Act so the CIA could know whether you were watching Prison Break or not. And the Federal Trade Commission set a new deadline for the switch from analog to digital broadcasting. It's a fad.
Yeah, it'll never stick.
No.
In the same week, the International Olympic Committee selected Vancouver as the host city for the 2010 Winter Olympics. A significant moment for the city in which I have done 100% of my directing to date, and I live pretty close to it. In music, Chris Brown's Run It peaked on the Billboard charts at number one. And in movies, the romantic comedy Just Friends, starring Ryan Reynolds and Amy Smart, was released in theaters. He was a flash in the pan. He'll never.
Yeah, he's not going to make it. Is that the fat suit movie? Do you remember?
I did not, in fact, watch that one. Wasn't that Shallow Hal?
No, that was also a fat suit movie, but that's different. All right, let's get into it. I love it when the summary, it's kind of general because to be totally honest, I don't remember all the twists and turns of this episode. So I get to be surprised all over again, although I remember a couple of the broad strokes and this is a juicy one.
This is a juicy one. Yeah, I brought popcorn.
All right. But you can't eat popcorn.
Are you food shaming me? Why can't I eat popcorn?
Because it's a podcast. Microphones, noise, podcast.
People don't want to hear me chew popcorn?
They don't. I don't. I mean, I do, okay, but I'm weird. I don't think our audience does. No.
I mean, if
we could be eating while we were watching, believe me, I'd be doing a lot of eating. I like to eat.
Okay, fine. We'll just watch. Okay.
All right, let's go do the watch. All right, everybody, we'll see you over at the watch.
So this would have been, if we had not gotten our back nine order, this would have been the season finale, right?
I don't think you can say that anymore. I don't think it's politically correct.
Hypovolemic?
Yeah, no, we don't say that anymore.
The hypovolemic community is...
Yeah, up in arms.
Or they would be if they weren't hypovolemic.
Yeah, if they weren't.
They could get out of bed. Stocky Beatrice? I mean, that could be a character in a John McClane ripoff of Die Hard.
It It's also particularly hard to act well and not make yourself sick.
Yeah, have you ever barfed while pretending to be sick?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Whew, it's a bad day at the office.
Barfing stories.
Barfing stories.
Putting it on the list.
And?
Wow.
Dude, whoa.
I'm... You said I have an ulcer. I think I have it, too. That was very...
Did I hear you squeal at one point?
No, I would never... No, I have a pet pig named Michael Swinefield.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I may have squealed a bit. There's some squealy moments.
We will be right back, and we're going to jump into this episode.
Okay. Okay, we're back. And I have a list of things to discuss. I have a list of things to discuss.
I have a list of things about which I'm disgusted. Yeah. Can I start, please, with the really, really stupid one that I just looked up? So in between, we just rewatched this together, took a little pee break, and I dug out my script because we were talking about stocky Beautrice mold, which I thought would be hilarious for a fan competition. You guys tell us.
Which is what Michael says when he's trying to delay the guards. He breaks a pipe, and then they say, you're going to have to clean this up tomorrow. And then he says, fine, don't worry about the stocky... What is it?
Stocky Beautrice mold is what
stocky
I heard.
Stocky Beautrice mold. And Bellick says, you're going to clean it up right now, Fisher.
And what I wrote... Right, so that they can be in there at 9 for the escape, et cetera. So I looked it up. It turns out that it's Streptococcus mold. At least that's what's in the production draft.
So
they said, I'm sure they said Streptococcus, and I heard Stocky Beautrice.
No. So I heard Stocky Beautrice too.
Did you?
Yeah. So that's just made up, is what you're telling me?
I don't know.
I mean, it would be funny if Michael was so smart and he knew that Bellick wouldn't know what the heck that was.
Totally.
And he just made up a scary... Because Streptococcus is, you'll get strep throat.
Which could kill you.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But is treatable easily with antibiotics.
He would know what that was. It maybe wouldn't freak him out as much. Okay, yeah. We need to get to the bottom of this somehow.
Also, here's what I'm calling the fan competition. Send us your best, who is Stocky Beautrice? What is Stocky Beautrice? Is it the horse that won the Kentucky Derby in 1913 and changed the fortunes of a family forever? The name of a mold first discovered on Mars and brought back with a rover.
And for a bonus, is Stocky Beautrice some Prison Break character that's just off screen?
The whole time.
Like, who is Stocky Beautrice?
Who is Stocky Beautrice? DM us your answers
to
this.
Actually, my...
And we'll send you a Prison Breaking merch mug or something.
It's my stripper name.
Stocky Beautrice.
Yeah.
Okay, now I want to see fan art.
He or she has a New Orleans, like Beautrice is like B-A-U-X.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Moving on.
Yes, please. My goodness.
Okay, what else did you want to talk about? Something
so
less stupid.
When we were talking to Karen Usher, we were talking about last time how the shows... The way that network television was structured was that you got an order of 13, and then in success, oftentimes, you would get a back 9. So there'd be 22 episodes. But in a show like this that is so heavily plotted, if you were going to do 13 would be the season finale. So they were kind of writing towards this being a season break cliffhanger, not the end of the show. So that I would assume, I mean, of course they could adjust that, but like you said, they were writing this 4 weeks before it was airing.
Which is crazy. Insane. I mean, that's practically live television. I wonder if Fox had not ordered a back 9, if the episode previous to this does not end with Lincoln going into the shoe, and they in fact escape in this episode, right? Like, that's one way that the season...
Oh.
Could have ended.
So there is no steel dead end. Like that does get him to the shoe. He does give him the cross. He takes the drug. He gets to the infirmary and they do get out.
And out they go.
So here's my...
In the Escalade.
That's very interesting. It's always interesting to see like where was the adjustment made to continue the season plot-wise. Mm-hmm. Here's my question. Was he always going to give him that pill to get him to the infirmary?
No, I don't think so.
Then how was Lincoln? Oh, because Lincoln was just going to be on PI with them.
Yeah, I think Lincoln, I think the previous episode would have ended with Lincoln not punching the guard.
Oh, they would have been in the break room together.
Lincoln is on PI.
Okay, so it's a cut. Yeah. It's an emergency.
It's a contingency plan.
Oh, because they have to get into the infirmary. He's already in the infirmary. They're actually coming up to him. Got it.
Right.
Got it.
Right.
I'm smart.
Although it's always possible that part of the plan would have been for Michael to give Lincoln that that pill in PI, right? And gone, take this at 8 o'clock. At 9
They'll
o'clock.
They'll take you to the infirmary.
Mm. Right.
Yeah. Here's my question. So does Michael really... Oh, he does decide, okay, we are going to do it tonight. Because there's this huge tension in the beginning of the episode. Like, we're not going without Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And then it's, well, I can get him to the... Mm-hmm. Boy, I love the cutting the thing out of your skin thing. That's amazing.
It's bonkers. Because there's also, in my mind, we have not talked to a writer about this. This is just my conjecture. There's a version where Sucre says, I don't have a razor blade. And it's like, does he chew it out? Like, there's gotta be, like,
there's also a version where Lincoln's like, I don't need a cross.
Totally.
Or he just puts it around his neck.
Yeah.
And you know, or dies. Whatever. Yeah.
On the electric chair.
And
the
also the fact that, like, we're just being idiots because one of the great joys of Prison Break is that there are a whole bunch of things that are obviously, as Karen Usher said, totally impossible. We're just going to keep referencing Karen Usher, who is a wonderful writer and was our guest on the last episode. But she said things like, oh, we did an incredible amount of research on prisons and their structure. And we actually stuck to the physical plant, but things like how electricity work, we weren't really interested in. I love that. Like, for instance, Sucre's mother's crucifix has a secret compartment in it.
Mm-hmm. And Sucre's has a crucifix. Well, I guess they would allow you to have religious.
Sure. But then it has a secret compartment in it that you can get a pill and a note.
Well,
eat 8:10.
I would say it didn't, but it's wood.
And he hollowed
so
it out.
Michael hollowed it out. Okay. Somewhere there's a scene where Michael is
hollowing out it and it breaks.
Desecrating.
And he's like, fuck. Oh yeah.
Oh, no, he's desecrating Sucre's mother's crucifix, and he's like, "This is awful."
We're not doing that.
Yeah.
You
100%.
Said something that Nick Santora said to you about what?
Yeah.
Nick Santora was another one of the Prison Break writers.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about the sort of accordion of a lot happens in an episode, a little happens in an episode. We know we have to get to here by the end of the season. And he said to me once, I will be honest, there are some episodes where it feels like we're stretching the taffy a little thin.
Uh-huh.
And I remember that image of like, stretching the taffy a little thin, because it's really true. Like, there are some episodes where so many things have to happen, like the last one and like this one. And then there are some episodes where it's like, well, all we really need to have happen is this one thing.
Well, the last episode was a taffy episode because it was like you went from A to X and then you end up back at A. So in a way, like, all this shit happens, but in terms of the overall story of getting out of the prison, they're in exactly the same place they were.
It's almost like a one-off.
But yeah, they do that a lot in this show where you don't know if this is important or if this is a dead end. And that's kind of part of the fun of Prison Break, right? Like, is Michael, like, here's a black dot. Does it mean something or does it not mean something?
Well, I mean, a little bit like setting up C-Note's whole phone call to replace Abruzzi's people, right? Like, Abruzzi's not there, so his plane isn't going to be waiting for them for the escape.
Right.
So C-Note sets up a backup escape, and there's a whole thing about it, which, of course, in the end doesn't matter because they don't escape. And so...
Right. But I believe those guys come back.
Do they?
I don't remember. I thought maybe that's still how they get out. But yeah, just some added tension, right?
Yeah. And... You know, and the beautiful C-Note, like, all of a sudden you see the man he is, the father he is, the husband he is, and the enormous lie he is telling.
Yeah.
That rather than being incarcerated in Fox River, he is in fact serving overseas in Iraq. Yeah.
In Kuwait.
Sorry, in Kuwait. You're right.
I which takes actually takes us nicely to the next point that I wanted to make, that even, I mean, I guess maybe this goes in with stretching the taffy, in that Prison Break, for all the twists and turns, and it's so plot-driven, it does, you know, you don't just hear C-Note has a family. You don't just have exposition of him saying, I got to get out of here, Fish. I got a little girl at home. They take the time to, I mean, that's a 2-minute scene.
It's a long one.
It's a long
scene.
Beautifully. And, you know, it's like a reveal. You get a reveal of the daughter. And then he says, I'm coming home. Put your mother on the phone. And then you realize, oh, she's being lied to as well.
The Iraq postcard.
Yeah. Yep. And it like, it makes his, it then like you reverse engineer seeing what C-Note has done to this point and you see it in a different light. In a similar way with Hale and Kellerman, when, you know, when Kellerman goes to see, you've seen Danny Hale having a crisis of conscience and he makes this decision at the end of the previous episode. And then you see he and his wife, she's pregnant, they're leaving. That all has a real emotional weight to it. But when Kellerman shows up at the door and she's like, oh, hi, Paul. Like that they know each other, that they've obviously been part of each other's lives for a long time. And then that Danny says in that scene, we went to the academy to get, like, there is this, they take the time to not just make reference to, but like, there's backstory that you get some time with. And I mean, I guess from the writer's perspective, if you're stretching the taffy, that is good to fill space, but I think it adds three-dimensionality in a thing that,
And I don't want to hit that too hard.
Well,
because
I think it's
sort of funny that when he, he said it, it was sort of a joke. Like they did have...
Of course. All shows have to do that.
Well, and you know, the other thing that I love about it is it gets us out of the prison. All of a sudden, you're like, ooh, you're in Hale's house. You're in... You're in C-Note's house. And, you know, I mean, I said this when we were looking, when we were doing the watch party, but I think you work with more actors than any other actor on the show because you're interacting with all these people, whereas the rest of us are like working with one or two, you know, or, I mean, even the Fox River 7, right? There's not that many people that they can interact with because
after the first few episodes, they're not meeting new people. We do meet Michelle Forbes in this episode.
Who
becomes a pretty big player in the show.
And she sort of takes over for Danny in some ways.
And kind of like supersedes me soon, I think.
So wait, tell me, going back, I want to hear more about that scene between you and Danny, who was also playing
Danny. I'll tell
you,
it was Friday night. It was very late. We were out in the, you know, downtown. And those scenes have a meta thing going on because it's his last scene. It's like when you die on a TV show, you go
away. Actually saying
like
goodbye.
You're also like, I don't have a job.
Right.
I mean, there is a lot of like, you know, in shows like this, people do flip through scripts and say like, oh, good, I'm alive at the end. And I don't know, I don't remember if we ever have Danny on, we'll talk to him about it, but you know, you get these jobs, a job like that. Like, I knew how many episodes I was doing. He didn't. It was like a week to week. Oh, you know, I'd call him and say, hey, you're in episode 5, you're in episode 7. Great. And then it's like, they're killing an episode, whatever. I'm sure he was doing a lot of theater at that time. So I'm sure that he needed a heads up so he could schedule his life. But there is a bittersweet. Like after that scene, and I know that it was the last scene he shot in the episode, you know, you stand up and the first AD puts his arm around him and says, everybody gather around. This is a series wrap on Danny. And everybody applauds. And then, you know, Danny and me and Jen Kern, who played his wife, who's a theater actor that we've known forever, we went to the Old Town Ale House and had a kind of farewell to him, which is kind of a well-known actor bar in Chicago in Old Town. And, you know, it was bittersweet. I loved working with him. And so it is helpful in that it imbues those scenes with the, like, you're saying goodbye to this person.
And You know, it's funny, the moment I often feel in those scenes, and usually for me, they're at the end of a show, but not always.
Is the end of the run of a show or the end of an episode?
The end of a run of a show or the end of a season. You know what I mean? Okay. Like, you never know. You're going to get canceled. You're going to get picked up, whatever. But whatever it is, you know, that you're right. The first AD puts their arms around you and goes, hey, this is their last night. The crew, you know, responds how they do. Usually they clap and it's really sweet. Sometimes it's Friday night at the end of a long week. They're like, yeah, man, I love you. And they like trudge back to pack down their trucks. Yeah. But then you go back to your trailer. And like, to me, those are the really interesting moments in life where you're like, this thing just happened, but also you still go through the motions of life. Like, you take your clothes, you fold them, you put them in the closet, you look at yourself, you clean your, you know, your stuff out of the trailer, and you go, oh, well, another suitcase in another haul. Like, here we go.
Yeah. Kearney people.
It's interesting. It's very, it's intimate because it's just that moment you have with yourself. And they're...
I have a little ritual. I have a couple little rituals I do to say goodbye and stuff like that.
Do you?
Yeah. I also think that it's interesting, and I know that you mentioned earlier that it was award season time, or that, like, I think we had just been nominated for People's Choice Awards or something, and, you know, 12 million people watched this episode. So this is episode 13. So I will also say, a lot of times when you make a film, certainly, and these days when you make a TV show, a lot of times you make a lot of it in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
Like the fact that this was written 4 weeks before it aired.
Yeah,
I mean, we were getting to do it and see it quickly. A lot of times you make something, you don't see it for a year. You don't see it, you're separate from it. And I do remember, this is the first experience, I had made a TV show in Vancouver, actually. We did 13 episodes. And it ended up airing like 2 years later and just getting burned off. Like, you had no connection to it in that way. This was the first time I experienced something where this show was a big deal.
Yeah.
And there's a real excitement about that. Obviously, the show's a success and everyone's feeling cool and good, and their friends are excited, and it's good for your career. But also, from a storytelling, I'll never forget this, from a storytelling perspective, you're like, this is going to blow people's fucking mind.
Mm.
But I remember reading this script and be like, oh, it's a cool, crazy moment for Kellerman. But I also knew that people out there were going to be really affected by it. And that is such a cool feeling. That, and you're going to get the satisfaction of it pretty quickly because we're shooting it and it's going to be on in a month.
And okay, so a couple of things about that. Number one, I think this was the last episode that aired in 2005. I think we had December off to catch up and came back. So in some ways, this was a giant cliffhanger.
Oh, so this was what they called like a mid-season finale.
I think. Because I don't think we had an episode.
We didn't stop shooting, obviously.
We did not.
No.
But it meant that the audience had to wait 4 or 5 weeks to see. Because the internet... The response to shows was almost immediate. You didn't have to wait for somebody to write something, for it to print, for six people you know to go, hey, did you see this article in the Tribune?
Right.
Well, but like, and so we had almost real-time feedback about how the show was going.
Yeah.
And shooting in Chicago, I don't know if you remember this, but I remember going from feeling completely anonymous, as I had been virtually my entire life. Up until that point, like, Tarzan had a couple fans, but like, when I say a couple, I mean like six.
Right.
To all of a sudden, you know, Wentworth and I went to brunch at Smith and Walensky most Saturdays in downtown Chicago. And I remember it going from, take a table wherever, to like, they had a private table with curtains for us.
Wow.
And I do remember too, this was
the curtains.
It's Chicago. It wasn't just for us. It was like, this is where we put people because it's the Myth of Walensky in Chicago.
Sure.
Like, in theory, they probably started for Al Capone or something. But like, and I do remember the waiter seating us one time and going, hey, I've just got to tell you, I love your show. Oh. And he's talking to Wentworth and he goes, you and that girl are fantastic. And Wentworth looks across the table at me and I just sort of shook my head and he goes, thank you. I'll let her know when we get back to work on Monday.
That's amazing.
But there was a level of, I mean, especially for Wentworth, of course, and Dominic, because their faces were on all the press and everything else and magazines. But it was weird. All of a sudden, like, I took the bus a lot in Chicago. We only had one car. Oh. And so I'd be on the bus from Wicker Park into downtown. And somebody would sit next to you. And the phenomenon of, like, oh my gosh, there's a fan. There's recognition. And that happened while we were then all the next day getting into the hair and makeup trailer together, yeah. Going, dude, you guys, this was the weirdest thing.
Yep.
Which in some ways was cool to experience together.
Oh, I thought it was really cool. I mean, I thought it was exciting. It was so exciting to have a show that people were hanging on every plot twist. It's really the beginning of the blogging about shows kind of almost in real time, like you said. And then everyone, and message boards, and it was...
chat rooms.
It was chat rooms. It was a there were conversations immediately that weren't just people making telephone calls to one another. And that was new at that time. And again, like, the nature of this show lends itself to that kind of engagement too.
Yes. It was water coolery. And of course, as we mentioned, you know, we were nominated for a People's Choice Award, which was the first award we were ever nominated for while we were shooting this scene.
Do you remember we went out?
Episode.
Do you remember we went out? We all met somewhere. Do you remember?
That was for the Golden Globes, House of Blues. Yes, I do. And I'll tell you that episode.
House of Blues? It was House of Blues. Wow.
I got us a private room at the House of Blues in Chicago. I will tell you that story on the next episode. Remind me.
I remember
because
the first...
Because a key component of that story was not... was not yet a member of the Prison Break family.
What? Wait, what a cliffhanger.
I'll give you
I remember
a little bit of a secret.
Yeah?
This episode is the last one where Mike Watkins' name appears on the script.
Oh.
I don't know the story behind that. That's 90% of it. But
I know some of that
There's a little
story.
More.
I know some of that story.
Okay. Let's...
I also remember, yes, I remember the House of Blues meeting, and I will, I guess we'll save that for the next time.
I think we should. It's a fun story. Okay, I also want to hear...
I remember Marshall telling us Marshall Allman, who played LJ, having a big announcement at that, too.
Oh, I think I remember this.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to make a note of
that. It was also
that.
The first time in my life, and maybe still the first, only time in my life, that I went out... The night before I had, like, when I was, had work the next day. Like, I wasn't drinking or anything, but I was still like, I just, you know, go to bed, da-da-da. I was like, oh my God, everyone's meeting at 10. I guess I'm going to go.
He's just been nominated for a Golden Globe.
No.
That was back when the Golden Globes were golden and globier.
Yeah.
The
things we didn't know. Right.
Okay, so I still have things I want to talk about. One thing that I mentioned, that we mentioned, was this beautiful cut between Lincoln bouncing his head off the back or tapping his head on the back of the wall, cutting to Michael doing the same thing.
Yeah.
That, as it turns out, was in the script.
Oh, cool. Read it. Can you read it
to us? Ooh, let me see. Yes. Okay. This is the production draft.
We said during the rewatch, I wonder if that... I said that's probably a directorial choice, not a script choice, but I'm clearly wrong.
You kind of never know. I mean, this was also... This was the production draft. So I'm sure there were lots and lots and lots of edits. But it started with...
Wait, that's the production draft and it's 4 weeks before?
Yeah, dude.
Oh, my God.
We were shooting live television. This is bananas. So scene 56, interior guard room, night one. Michael, his usual unflappable demeanor, showing subtle signs that he's feeling the pressure. He bangs the back of his head against the wall, lightly gritting his jaw. Match cut to scene 57. Interior shoe night, Link backing the back of his own head against the wall as the minutes pass. Now they reversed that.
They cut from
Lincoln to Michael.
Uh-huh.
But it's
wow.
You know,
it's a very nice piece of writing.
Very nice piece of writing.
Paul T. Shearing, yeah. That's lovely.
You want to tell me your barfing story?
I've so many, but hold on, you had better stuff about. I mean, that's just kind of general acting stuff about barfing on screen.
Oh, wait. Okay, wait. But can I, you said acting stuff, can I back up for a second? Because I was thinking in the scene that you shot with Danny.
Yeah.
and the scene that you shot with his wife. I thought it was really, really nice work and really understated. And I realized a question I hadn't asked you that I'm really curious about, which is, if you're willing to share it, what is your prep like at the beginning of a shoot day? And I'm asking partly because as I'm going through these scripts of mine, I'm realizing that a lot of these notes are the very earnest notes of a green actor.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out technically how to do the job.
Yeah.
And you were ahead of me, and there was a confidence with the way that you worked that I really admired when we were working together.
I was also pretty green. I'd done a bunch of work. I had not been asked to do that kind of thing yet that much. I'd been on dramas, I'd been in comedies, but I hadn't. Mm. The stakes of this were high, character-wise. Mm-hmm. And also, I remember that night being like, oh, this is... I've never done this before.
Mm.
Part of my prep was to connect to the personal relationship with Danny because I knew that, like you said, it has to cost him something. Otherwise, mm-hmm. we don't care. I don't remember when that speech, which I really
that you named me is great
thing. I loved how that was written. So my prep was, I did a lot of research early. Secret Service, CIA, and especially Special Forces, in the American military, and kind of trying to get into what that mentality meant. And the thing that I found, because, you know, again, this is like peak war on terror era.
Mm-hmm.
I fall on a part of the political spectrum that was, you know, not very supportive of that. And I needed to put myself in the mindset of someone who was.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really educational for me.
Hmm.
It certainly expanded my...
Cool exercise in compassion.
And like, yeah, totally expanded my view of the world and different political views, but also the thing that I learned that I learned a lot of things, but one of the things I had to make him a true believer, right? He believes that what he's doing, while it may be outside the bounds of the law, is for a higher purpose. And the thing that I latched onto for that scene and that relationship is that and I remember we saw Jarhead together. Do you remember me, you, and Josh saw Jarhead together?
Oh, no way.
And in the book of Jarhead, in the book, he does a really interesting run about what they do in the military is that they make you fight. They bond you to your partner. They bond you to your squad. So when you're out there doing it, you're not, I mean, yes, you're fighting for the United States of America, but you're really fighting for your brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the idea that Danny and I had been bonded so far back, I really tried to dig into that so that then the betrayal could really affect me.
It's very an A2 Brute. But I want to drill down a little bit further if I can.
Yep.
And again, if you're not interested in sharing, this is totally fine because it's super personal for
we'll
a lot of people.
Talk about myself as much as you want.
What? Outstanding. But what is your on the day? Like you show up in your trailer.
Yeah.
Do you stretch? Do you do yoga? Do you knit to Metallica? Whatever. Like, how is it that you transition from Paul Adelstein to Paul Kellerman?
Depending on the day and what's being asked of you, because so much of acting on TV and film is that there is not a routine. It's like some days you show up at 6 a.m. and some days you show up at 6 p.m. So staying, whatever it takes to stay loose and fresh. So usually that means kind of like working out and with a character like Kellerman, like, yeah, going on my trip, stretching, like stretching my voice out, like staying loose, getting too worked up and not staying too relaxed.
Mm-hmm. It's a fine line, hey?
A real fine line. And then I'll remember for that scene, I had read this book, How to Stop Acting by Harold Guskin.
Oh, that's a great title.
Yeah. Some of the stuff in that book is really, really helpful. Some of it for me, and some of it isn't. This was peak Sopranos. And, Guskin was, I think, Gandolfini's acting teacher. So there was a lot of stuff about working with Gandolfini. There's this one exercise that he would do to be emotional And emotional is something they put in scripts and that directors mm-hmm. talk about where you're like, what does that mean? You want me to cry? What does right. that mean? You want me to have higher stakes? But sometimes that is the only definition they'll give you. Mm-hmm. And there's this exercise that Guskin talks about, the Gandolfini does all the time, which is frankly just a breathing exercise that kind of makes you emotional because it triggers a sense memory in you. It's like if you get upset, a certain thing happens to you physiologically. The philosophy here is if you do the physiological thing, it'll actually mm-hmm. trigger the upset.
You can work from the outside in or the inside
out. Kind of work from the outside in. So I was doing that breathing exercise in the car. I just remember doing it before I got out of the car. Mm. But I was a little green too, and I got a little too obsessed with the exercise and kind of lose my... Right, but I'm just doing a scene.
Right.
I just need to go out there and look at Danny.
Right.
Like you can do all those exercises and then... And I remember being unhappy with some of those takes and happy with some of them and hoping that they were going to use the ones I liked.
Mm-hmm.
So...
So hard to let that control go.
Yes. And my process was, I have a thing, and you know, again, this is just me, where I do a lot of that work and then sometimes I have trouble letting go and giving over to whatever the rhythm of the shoot is. I want to come, why are we wait? You know, I don't yell at anybody mm-hmm. or anything. I'm just in the car. I'm ready. I'm primed. Let's go. Getting out of
sure.
Oh, we got to go back to one. We screwed up the, oh my God, I was going to be great in that one. Letting go of that mentality and just letting each one come is something that I feel like I was already starting to battle with a little bit. And I was happy with how I ended up letting go in that night because it was a weird shoot. And as you could tell with the lighting, that lighting is very precise.
Very precise.
So even though it's a very dynamic scene, I remember it there being a whole thing about how am I going to open that letter
right?
and hold with the gun and I have a broken finger. So I will also have you know that I shot him lefty.
Oh, you sure did. Wow, I never would have noticed that. Thanks for pointing that out. That's really cool.
And I remember
cool.
I had to put the gun on the other side of my bot. Like it became a whole thing.
But it's actually wonderful to watch you struggle with something in that moment.
They didn't want me to. I remember they wanted, I was like, oh, maybe you can just take it out of the.
But
I was
even
like, no,
like,
it'll be fast. I promise. It'll be fast. I promise. Like, we were like, we don't want this to become a scene about opening a letter. I was like, right.
No,
I don't
but
know
it's
if I'm
cool
answering your question
becomes,
about what.
You are. No, you really are. And I mean, it's what was interesting to me and part of why, like, it's one of these things every time we finish an episode, I was like, oh, crap, I want to ask Paul more about that. But I noticed, like, I write a lot of notes to myself in the first, you know, on the title page or the cast list page of my script a lot. And one of the things that I notice, I actually wrote in French because I was so embarrassed that anybody might read
it. Oh, that's so funny and cute. Cute is the wrong word, but you know what I mean? Endearing.
It is kind of endearing. Like, again, I look at this person as somebody who's so far removed from me now. But what I wrote in French was... really look at other people. Because when I would get too in my head preparing, it's like I would look at them, but I was looking at them in quotes. And it's like sometimes you just gotta drop it.
I have that all over my scripts.
Is that right?
Listen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you're like, you were gonna see, you were gonna see, and you're like, oh, right, hold on. I need to look. Yeah. I need to make sure that when I show up here, I don't have this shit in my head.
Right.
So sometimes
acting is
it's
actually
good.
Listening. Yeah.
Acting is actually just standing there and receiving, but you got to get yourself in a place that you can do that. But I'm interested to hear what you think green notes are. Like, why you probably knew way more than you thought you did. And also your work is, I was actually want to talk about the scene with you and Went because what you called Victorian hand porn. He's different in that scene than I've seen him be in this series.
Yeah.
There's a kind of lightness in him, even though his brother's about to die and he knows he's about to escape, where he's saying goodbye to you. It's very sparse. Do you ever think about what could be different? And mm-hmm. she's trying not to get taken in by it. And you won't look at him at one point. It's very, and you let him, yet you let him take your hand. So when you say, it's, and look, here's the thing. I don't know what went into that. But all I know is that, like, audience brain likes it, but then my actor brain says, well, why does this work? And all I can come up with is, well, they're very connected and they're really listening to each other and they're very much on the same page in what has to happen in this scene. So, you know, all these things we talk about, the notes I made, the prep I did, they're really all, like I said, oh, the Guskin book has some good things for me, some bad things for me. For somebody else, those things may be reversed. Like, it's whatever gets you to standing in that friggin' spot, listening and responding to that other person and trying to affect them. Like,
whatever
methodology
that is
you need. So what are, give me some notes. I want to know, like, what you are saying are green. And you're not looking at your script right now. You're looking up, so you're not going to tell me.
No. I do have my script here. I mean, part of, I think, the process of being on Prison Break to me, and I want to try and find them. Maybe if we do this for a second season. I had a friend of mine had read a book called The Artist's Way.
Oh, yeah.
Which I never read. But apparently, one of the suggestions is write 2 pages in a journal every day. Just whatever comes out of your head. Yeah. And I started doing that as a way of kind of bridging me and my character when I'd get into the trailer in the morning. You know, I'd like do some yoga, whatever, but like start to like get what was in my head on paper so that I could let it go. And then start to kind of move into that. And I think the process of Prison Break for me in a lot of ways was taking everything that I had been taught about how to act in drama school.
Yeah.
About this is what a play is, and this is what the text is, and this is what a warm-up is. Which was helpful, but also I found rigid and somewhat not useful for work on camera.
Sure.
And edit it into an actual actionable set of techniques for myself. Because when you're inspired and everything's fine, it's great.
Well,
that's not when you need the technique, right? You need the technique for, like, I have a 4 a.m. call and I haven't slept. And
anybody can be good when they're feeling it.
Right.
Right. Right. Anybody can get in the zone.
And one of the meanest things I've ever heard a director say about an actor, understanding the implications of it, is she can't do the same thing once. Which,
oh my God, that's fucking brutal.
It's super brutal. But it was a way of warning me as somebody who was going to direct, like, just FYI, you're going to get one brilliant performance. Then you're going to get another brilliant performance.
Yeah.
You will never be able to cut those two things together.
Right.
So just understand that. But so, like, okay, here's something that I wrote. And this kind of comes to the Victorian hand porn thing. I wrote a note in the script at the bottom of the page. Keep eyes off him. Physical focus. My physical focus should be completely professional.
And that's great. And that works. And I totally noted that.
Well, and we talked. We argued. Actually, so backing up a little bit. Wentworth and I really were interested in a similar style of acting, which is you can't tell the difference between the conversation we're having before and after action, right? They should be equally relaxed and naturalistic. And for our scenes, it worked. And one of the things that directors were constantly getting us to try and do is look at each other.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Make eye contact.
Gaze into each other's eyes.
Yes.
Because that's a visual cue of these people like each other, have tension, all that. Yeah.
And the best acting teacher I ever had is a brilliant man named Larry Hecht. And he always said that people who hold eye contact for more than 60 seconds are going to be fighting or fucking in the next 30 seconds in life. So if you're staring into somebody's eyes in television for 3 minutes of a scene, the audience knows it's a lie. Unless you're fighting or fucking as soon as it's over, which happens a lot on TV. And so we were constantly going, no, I'm sorry, like, love and respect. No, I don't want to look at him. I don't want her to look at me. Like,
and what that shows is that you do want to fuck him. I mean, the fact that you don't want to look at him is telling.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very telling.
Restraint,
very,
I think.
And
is,
very effective.
Yeah. So yeah, the hand porn thing was funny because they'd been trying, like, the writers and the directors had been trying to get us to either hold hands or kiss or something for, at this point, a solid 6 episodes. And we kept just going like, no problem, but why? Why? I think we can sell it another way. Why? And then the show came out and we're like, oh, okay, it's working. And so in this one, it was like, he takes her hand. And apparently Wentworth called me the next, like a day or two after this episode aired. And he was like, the internet's calling it Victorian hand porn. And we thought it was very funny.
It's just very, very effective. I wanted to say something else about the prep for all the things I said about like Kellerman prep and all that stuff. I don't know if it's because what my training was, like, you know, being in a commedia dell'arte company in Chicago that was like, we did hours and hours and hours of crazy white face that we would make and all these fat pads and sweat and these outrageous characters. And we would talk about image a lot because you're playing a stock character. And we'd spend a lot of time what we called in the mirror. Like I look like a industrialist from 1930s Germany. There's like crazy eyebrow. Like, and you would try to take what you saw and then imbue that with these incredibly heightened emotions. But a lot of it was like, what is this image portraying? And not superficially, I just mean, what are you
creating? What's the archetype?
Yeah, what's the archetype? So a huge help for me with Kellerman was the coat, the suit, the tie, the pin, the ring, the sunglasses, the car, the gun, the crew cut. Like it was very much like armor. Very much a uniform. Yeah. When I put it on, once you've done it a few times, it really helps. I don't wear a suit and tie every day. So when I put a suit and tie, when I put that suit and tie on, it really felt like I'm going into.
Same, actually.
Sure. For instance, if I was dressed in, I don't think you've seen Kellerman in civilian clothes at this point. Those are civilian clothes, but you know what I mean. It would have been a different kind of scene. Like, Danny's not wearing a coat and tie. Like, he's in his
the power
sweater.
Dynamic there.
Yeah. And so it felt like I'm at work, you know, and then to let the emotional part of you betrayed me into that space, it kind of does its own work then. Because you see that armor. I say, hey, it's cracking the armor, but you see him, see that thing get through.
Yes, for the very first time. And actually, I think what's interesting about both of these scenes is that they're built on, at this point, 12 episodes of restraint.
That's right.
Which is, we have not seen Kellerman get teary-eyed over pulling a trigger. We have not seen Michael get through to Sarah in a way that she's kind of willing to countenance. But because of that restraint, and this is something that I found sometimes challenging with television directors who want to pack it all into their episode. And I'm like, listen, I get it. And I love that you want to make this the best episode of the season. However, I'm not running a sprint. I'm running a marathon.
That's right.
And if you do certain things on mile 15, by the time I get to the very last 500 yards, nobody's going to care. And that is one of the things that I think becomes a balance between actors and directors and writers and directors and stuff on episodic TV. Okay. I do think we should probably cut to a quick commercial and then answer like one fan question because we're so out of time.
We've blah and blah and blah. Okay. We'll be right back.
Yeah. But thanks for sharing all this because it's been really cool.
You too.
Okay. We'll be back. Okay. Welcome back. We have a bunch of questions that we're just not going to get to. And I love you guys. Thank you. We will import some of these to next week's episode and see if we can get to that. But what about question 11 here, Paul? The hardest moment for you in this series
as
a character and actor? Maybe let's limit it to this season?
Oh.
Like, was that Danny moment?
That was the hardest moment. Yeah, I think it was the hardest. It was the most complex thing I think I do in season one and wanted to get right. So yeah, it was definitely a challenge. What about you?
Weirdly, the hardest one I think for me, there's a scene, and this is way, way, way down. This is probably one of the last two episodes. It's just Sarah alone crying in a car.
Oh, yeah.
And I was away. I don't remember what I was doing. It might have been press for the show. It might have been something family related. But they had said, you've got the week off. I left Chicago. And then they called me a couple days later and they said, we need you to come in and film.
A crying scene. Just come in and cry in a car.
Crying in the car.
Context?
I think it was about the decision of leaving the door open.
Okay, okay.
So giant character moment. Crying on camera. I don't know if I'd ever done it before. It was so intimidating to me. Because my whole philosophy of acting was all about like restraint. And to be honest, I didn't feel, and this is not an indictment, but I didn't feel so like safe and supported on that set that I felt like I could just kind of access easy work. Mm. And I remember they flew me in, like got off the plane, went straight to set.
Oh my gosh. It was
the end of a night shoot. I think it was a second unit. And so it's also part of a weird thing about a second unit is you roll up and half the time you don't know the crew.
And they don't know you.
So like the guy who's wiring you, you're like, oh, hey, nice to meet you. I'm Sarah.
Oh,
and
God.
So there's not even that familiarity of, I always felt super safe with our crew. You know what I mean? And so you're like, oh, hey, Tony, what's up? Oh, hey, you know, like those were the people that made you feel like you were home. And like I sat in the car and the director was like, and action.
Oh, jeez. Oh, jeez.
And I was like, and so it was, that was probably one of the hardest. One of the most difficult, just again, from a technical perspective, that was a challenging one.
One more question and we'll answer very quickly.
Yeah.
This is for fun, but who do you guys think had the highest kill count on Prison Break for season one?
I would definitely say
Teabag or Kellerman, and I will say it's Kellerman.
It's gotta be Kellerman because Teabag doesn't have a gun.
Correct.
If you gave Kellerman's weapons to Teabag?
Maybe.
Different story.
I got the full force of the United States Armed Forces and the United States government behind me.
All right, like full diplomatic immunity,
correct.
Apparently.
Apparently. All right.
By the way, did they bring Patty Wettigan for one line?
Apparently.
I think they did, right? She just goes, somebody talked. And
yep.
It's like, it's amazing.
Yep.
That is a very expensive line. I don't know what she cost an episode, but it's not $11.50, and no. I'm very glad that she got that check. Go, Patty.
Yes. Yes. Love that, Patty. Okay. Well, I think that does it. Another episode of Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul. Please follow us on Instagram at Prison Break Podcast.
And don't forget to call into the Prison Breaking Hotline at 4013-P-BREAK. That's P-R... No, it's not. It's P-B-R-E-A-K. And this week's question... If you had to pick one of the Fox River Seven to leave behind, who would it be and why? Except Teabag. You can't pick Teabag.
Yeah, you can't pick Teabag.
Because quite frankly, you don't pick Teabag. You're a terrible person.
That's right. We're not doing the contest on the thing. That'll be a different contest. The mold contest?
No. So the what was it? The Stocky Boutrice mold.
Yeah.
Please DM us on our Instagram.
Got it. Sorry.
And we will announce winners via Instagram. And then the winner can send us their address and we will send you PB swag.
Swag. And if send us your address and we will send one of the Fox River Seven to hide out in your home.
We, in fact, will not.
Okay.
So I'm worried about saying that publicly.
Okay,
so credits.
Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul is a Caliber Studio production.
Your hosts have been friends but not besties, Sarah Wayne Callies and Paul Edelstein.
Our prison warden has been producer Ben Haber.
Keeping us slim and trim in the prison yard has been sound designer and editor Jeff Schmidt.
Keeping us up to date on the outside world is production assistant Drew Austin. Our prison artist, logo, brand designer, tattoo artist is John Nuziato and Little Big Brands. Check them out at www.littlebigbrands.com.
Follow us on Instagram at Prison Break Podcast. Email us at prisonbreaking@caliber-studio.com and call us at 4013-P-BREAK.
Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul has been a Caliber Studio production. Thank you for listening.
Bye.
See you next time. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul is a Caliber Studio production. Your hosts have been friends, but not besties, Sarah Wayne Callies and Paul Edelstein. The prison warden has been producer Ben Haber. Keeping us slim and trim in the prison yard has been sound designer and editor Jeff Schmidt. Keeping us up to date on the outside world is production assistant Drew Austin. Letting the world know what's been happening to us. Our music was done by Paul Edelstein. Our prison artist, logo, and brand designer is John Nunziato and Little Big Brands. Check him out at www.littlebigbrands.com. Follow us on Instagram, Prison Break Podcast. Email us at prisonbreaking@caliberstudio.com. And call us at 4013-P-BREAK. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul has been a Caliber Studio production. Thank you for listening.